ስንተቃቀፍ ቀን በቀን ጊዜውን በደስታ ስናሳልፍ
Welcome to Eye on the Middle East, a weekly podcast produced by NeonTommy.com at USC Annenberg Digital News. Today is November 9th, 2011, and I'm your host, Benjamin Gottlieb.
And I am your co-host, Arzu Rezvani. On today's program, Syria's defected soldiers and Iran's unwillingness to retreat from a nuclear program. Joining us for our main discussion on new media and the Arab Spring is Clay Shirky.
The Eye on the Middle East podcast can now be found on iTunes. Just search for Neon Tommy, Eye on the Middle East.
Reports from Al Jazeera suggest that the Syrian army, which has been used to crush uprisings that began in March, are split over the tactics being used against civilians. Soldiers who have defected say that they are determined to protect peaceful protesters and topple the Bashar al-Assad government. Let's listen to a clip from an Al Jazeera report filed earlier today.
Before I defected, we suffered hardship in the army. We were forced to do everything against our will, especially as we are low-ranking soldiers. We were like servants. I felt I was not serving my country, only serving the officers. Bribery was endemic in the army. We did not get any leave unless we paid money.
So this certainly isn't the first time we've seen members of a military apparatus defect, Ben. Do you think that the end is near for the Bashar al-Assad government?
Well, I think that the increase of defection within the army is important to note, and it does mark an interesting time here for Assad's government. More than 3,000 Syrians have been killed as of today. I think the exact number reported by the UN Human Rights Office is about 3,500 Syrians that have been killed in Syria. Following the Arab League resolution, violence has actually increased in Syria, and I think we can look to the end for I think we're looking at the end of Bashar's government, but he's not going to go down without a fight. I mean, I think we're going to see, I would anticipate a very similar reaction from Bashar that we saw with Gaddafi, fighting to the bitter end. And the difference here is that Bashar has a lot more leverage. He has the support of the Chinese and the Russians in the Security Council. There has not, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I do not think there has been a UN resolution to call for intervention in,
I think you're
in
right.
Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because Syria has a higher profile than Libya.
And then you touched on the deal that Syria made last week with the Arab League. Where are they with that agreement?
Well, they struck a deal last week, as we spoke on our show, to remove armored vehicles and tanks from some of the hot spots in Syria, including Homs, which is in the south. And what has happened since then is violence has increased. It was seen by the rebels in Libya as a victory. However, what has happened is that Bashar has cracked down even more on the protests, and he's done this through a variety of ways. He's done this through the increased role of the military, which seems pretty silly given the fact that military crackdown in the government has been widespread, and Syria's military force is kind of operating as a containment force against its own people, less so than what a normal military force would operate as. But we've also seen Bashar crack down on social media and on the use of Facebook to organize and the use of other media outlets on the internet to organize protests. Moving to Iran, Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad spoke on Wednesday and responded to a report from the International Atomic Energy Agency, which alleged that Iran was close to developing a nuclear warhead. The nuclear conversation seems to have dominated our relationship, or lack thereof, with Iran. Explain the concern over having a nuclear Iran.
So Iran's history with developing a nuclear arsenal is a fascinating one that can be traced back to decades ago with the U.S. and Israel. They were actually quite keen on having Iran develop nuclear capabilities. In fact, there was a point in time when Iran was working fairly closely with Israel in developing such a program. Things took a sharp turn, of course, when the Iranian Revolution took place and when the Iranians tried to restart their program without reporting their activities to the IAEA. There's just a great degree of mistrust between the U.S. and Iran, and also between Israel and Iran, when it comes to a nuclear program, and a great deal of tension has emerged from the lack of transparency from the Iranians beyond claims that their programs would be for peaceful use.
Don't you think that the connection between the Iranian regime and the terrorist cells that operate out of Lebanon, like Hezbollah, and their influence with Syria raises or heightens concern amongst the West and particularly Israel when talking about Iran's nuclear program?
Sure. I do understand the concern. There is a pretty certain link between the terrorist organizations in Syria, in Lebanon, and Iran. But I would argue that that's a completely separate issue. What we seem to be hearing from Washington and certain groups that represent Israeli interests is that the person sitting at Iran's helm, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, he is an irrational actor. And that's where a lot of the concern rests. And I would argue that he's not, and the regime is not irrational. If they were irrational, I don't think that they would be able to hold power for 30 plus years.
No, that's a good point. Although, as you and I both know, Ahmadinejad has come under fire from the Iranian regime recently, and there's been talks about removing him, deposing him. So I think there is also divisions within the Iranian regime.
Absolutely.
Today.
There's no doubt about it. But I don't think that the solution to this problem is mean talk. I think that there needs to be better engagement with Iran, whether that's through the IAEA going in and monitoring what they're doing with their nuclear activities. That's an avenue that has been explored in the past, and I think that it needs to be reconsidered again. This is going to be a really slow process, and it's going to be difficult for the Americans to restart that process of engagement again, because there's just a lot of cynicism around Iran, especially when you have the president going to certain forums and saying certain things about the Holocaust and 9/11, the fact that it possibly did not happen. So it's very hard to consider a policy of engagement with them.
Yeah, definitely. I think that the major concern, and I'm sure you would agree with me, is that we're not going to see the Israelis selling technology, nuclear technology, or trading nuclear technology with other countries that are going to threaten Iran. I mean, granted, the countries that are at odds with Iran today already have the nuclear capabilities, and so that's not necessarily an issue. The issue is that there's concern that Iran would sell or push some of this nuclear technology or even weapons to organizations that would threaten the existence of Israel. And I don't think that the Israelis are necessarily planning to preemptively use a nuclear weapon on the Iranians.
Right. Even after this week's show by members of AIPAC, you don't think that they're willing to strike?
I'm not with a nuclear
just
weapon. Saber
rattling on their part.
Let's take a quick break and remind you that you are listening to On the Middle East. I'm your host, Benjamin Gottlieb.
And I am your co-host, Arzu Rezvani. New media expert Clay Shirky will be joining us in our next segment to discuss the role of new media tools in the Arab Spring. Clay Shirky is currently a partner for technology and product strategy at the Accelerator Group and a professor of new media at Hunter College, where he teaches in both the undergraduate and graduate programs. In addition to teaching, Professor Shirky's writings are currently focused on the Internet's effect in shifting power from producer to consumer in the media landscape, the Internet economy, and especially its effects on national culture, and open source software and the post-PC network ecology. Clay, it's great to have you on the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So there has been a lot of talk about how new media tools and technologies have played such a key role in the Arab Spring. To what extent do you think that real-time tools like Twitter or Facebook play a role in a people's revolt?
You know, I don't think you can say a people's revolt is a kind of general category. One of the things we've seen is that Differing regimes respond in different ways to different pressures. Certainly the fact that Egypt and Tunisia fell quickly, Libya descended into a civil war, that Syria has just turned into a kind of bloodbath, Bahrain is becoming effectively an anti-Shiite apartheid state, means that there isn't a single dial labeled real time that when you dial it up you get one coherent set of effects. That having been said, what we do see with the social media tools, what we do see with tools that allow for both amateur access to public speech and for group coordination, is that it allows a committed group of citizens a way of taking on the state in a way that at least so far the states have a hard time responding to in completely coherent ways. There is what's called the dictator's dilemma that these tools force onto autocratic regimes. And when I think about the effect of these tools on those regimes, what I think I'm seeing can be kind of broken down just as a model along three axes. These tools have done a better job of allowing citizens to synchronize their opinions, right? If you look at the Kefaya movement in Egypt starting in about 2004, it was a largely blog-based movement, which allowed for a bunch of ideologically distinct actors in the Egyptian political scene, like the Muslim Brotherhood and the relatively secular pro-democracy movements, to all agree that whatever else they disagreed about, they wanted Mubarak out. The second effect is to coordinate action. It was possible for the Egyptian dissidents to say in advance, we are hijacking National Police Day. We're taking over January 25th and we're turning it into a kind of ironic protest day. Even though it's National Police Day, we're actually having a kind of an anti-police statement. And they could spread that message throughout the population without having to get permission or help from state media. And then the third thing, which I underestimated, but has turned out to be one of the few universals of this wave of protest movements, is documenting the results. Right, the ability of the Bahraini people, to document state intervention in the Pearl Roundabout in Bahrain, or the ability of people to continue to use their cell phones to take photos and videos in Syria and to get them out and then up to YouTube and distributed widely.
Now, Clay, let's return to the idea you brought up about the dictator's dilemma. Bashar al-Assad is trying to snuff out opposition in Syria by silencing the media and blocking access to social media services like Facebook,
right. Like
Twitter.
Right.
And this is a tactic that we've seen work very effectively in places like Iran and in China, among others. For our listeners, Clay, can you walk us through, I guess, the basics of how something like that was done, how social media can be stifled?
Well, social media can be stifled in a number of ways. The most blunderbuss tactic was, of course, the one that Mubarak adopted in Egypt, which is to just shut down the network. And the effects there were so dramatic, so rapid, and so much the opposite of what Mubarak wanted, that I think it essentially put the autocracies of the world on notice, that cutting off countrywide access actually radicalizes parts of the population that did not previously sense themselves to be involved in the ideological dispute. They weren't previously radicalized. So what countries particularly like Iran and China do is they do selective time-based, space-based, and sometimes content-based shutdowns where they will attenuate the network, they will make it run slowly so that people can send mail, but they can't watch video or they can't upload video. They will block out cell tower, particular cell towers in particular regions on particular days when there's threat of coordinated action. The Chinese have become very committed to the idea that they will desynchronize public opinion. So, for instance, on Sina Weibo during the rise of the Arab Spring, they didn't ban the word Egypt, and they didn't ban the word jasmine, but they did prevent it from showing up in trending topics. Mm-hmm. So there the goal was not to keep people from talking about those things because they didn't want to tip their hand, because in the dictator's dilemma, they didn't want to let the citizens know that they were worried. But they wanted to prevent the citizens from realizing that everybody else was talking about that at the same time. And this is really, I think, this is why media that allows for social coordination is such a big deal. governments are not, particularly authoritarian governments, they're not afraid of empowered individuals. They're afraid of coordinated groups. And so in many cases, the strategy now is to allow a dissident subculture to operate, but to prevent them from synchronizing the opinions of a public outside the dissident group.
Now, the U.S. government has denounced the technological monitoring of citizens and the control of cellular and internet networks in the past. But then you have incidents like the one in August in which mobile service was shut down in San Francisco, of all places, to prevent protests, from the shooting and death of Charles Blair. Can we expect to see more of this kind of interference, especially, say, if the Occupy Wall Street protests escalate?
Well, I mean, God, you know, God forbid, I think has to be the answer of anybody who cares about democracy. What they did in Oakland was visibly odious. And that, I think that control of freedom of speech as an element of control of populations around protests is so antithetical to really the core spirit of the First Amendment, right? There have been debates about whether or not the First Amendment protects speech outside political speech, you know, kind of constructivist versus expansionist arguments, but there is no way to say that speech that is related to freedom of political assembly does not fall under First Amendment controls. What I find so interesting about this is I think the tension you were alluding to, which is State Department policy would like to say, we want the citizens of the world's governments to be able to register protest against those governments, particularly if they are autocratic regimes. But if that policy is followed, then it is clear that what was committed in Oakland wasn't just bad, but unconstitutional.
Absolutely.
And so we now have this situation in which a formerly robust separation between local public policy and foreign policy. You could pursue one foreign policy around freedom of speech and a different foreign policy locally. That is starting to evaporate. Another example was our pursuit, mainly through pressure from Congress, of extra legal controls on WikiLeaks, right? Famously convincing Amazon to kick them off their servers, denying them access to U.S. credit card infrastructure and so forth. And it was so undermining of Secretary Clinton's message of internet freedom to have her own government use extra legal tools to go after WikiLeaks that I'm starting to believe that the distinction between local policy and foreign policy, which has been a hallmark of the U.S. government for as long as we've had anything worth calling a foreign policy.
Sure.
I think that is starting to evaporate.
Well, I mean, Clay, obviously the argument was that WikiLeaks was a threat to national security, and that's why we had the government
the
coming
Chinese
out that way.
The Chinese could make that same argument. The Syrians can make that same argument. I perfectly understand that there's a group of people who believe that national security is the root password to the Constitution, but Even if you invoke national security, it does not get you out of the dilemma of, are we a country that believes that citizens should be free to speak, their minds and free to discuss politically important issues, or are we not?
Social media was used by protesters well before this year's Arab Spring. Demonstrators were using social media tools in Belarus, for example, in 2006, in Thailand in 2010.
Right.
Right. Why has it been more effective for some movements and less effective for others, would you say?
Well, certainly the single biggest predictor of the responsiveness or the effectiveness of social media is actually the responsiveness of the government to the citizens, right? In almost all of the cases we had prior to Ben Ali fleeing the country, actually, come to think of it, I believe in all cases prior to Ben Ali fleeing the country, every unscheduled change in the executive that was created by insurgents or protesters using social media happened in a democracy. In the Philippines, in Spain, in Thailand, there were all of these examples where social media became a coordinating tool for people determined to make a democratic government respond to citizen pressure. It was really not until January 14th of this year that we saw an unscheduled change in executive office of an autocratic regime when Ben Ali fled the country. So one of the things that says is that it is just much, much harder to do in autocracies because autocracies are, by definition, less responsive to public pressure and have the opportunity of both violence and suppression much more readily at the hand than democracies do.
In an issue of Foreign Affairs back in March, you said that the political impact of social media has focused on the power of mass protests to topple governments, whereas media's real potential lies in supporting civil society in the public sphere.
Right.
So talk to us a little bit about how you see social media supporting civil societies and the public in the foreseeable future.
So this gets back to this sort of, you know, breakdown of synchronization of opinion, coordination of action, documentation of results. The exciting part, and the part that I had focused on in 2008 when I wrote Here Comes Everybody, particularly the political chapter of that book, the book that examines politics, the exciting part is the use of those tools to turn people out in the streets, right? This famous information cascade in which a bunch of people who are dissatisfied with the society see other protesters not suffering too much, join the protest, gets larger, that convinces more people to join, and you get this famous information cascade. What I didn't do a good enough job of assessing at the time, and what the Foreign Affairs article was written in part to correct, was that effect, the ability to turn people out on the street, is the end of a long process rather than a shortcut. It relies first on having a group of people who essentially know and trust one another enough to be willing to turn out in the first place. And so when we look at the Tunisian situation, when we look at the Egyptian situation, and particularly when we compare them to things like Burma or Sudan, where there isn't a deep civil society, or even frankly Libya, where the civil society was so fractured and contentiously competitive with one another. What we see is that the countries where this kind of turnout worked best were places where there had been years of conversation in advance among people who were politically like-minded enough to agree on a strategy.
Clay, thanks so much for joining us today.
Not at all. Great to talk to you guys.
This is Eye on the Middle East, broadcast live from the USC Annenberg Graduate School of Journalism.
Please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Just search for Neon Tommy, Eye on the Middle East. Thank you so much, and stay tuned for next week's podcast. And of course, as always, take care.